King of Worshipers! Where's all of my praises? I want everybody around the world to put your hands together because all the praise belongs to God. Here we go.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
I'm Gary Null, broadcasting video streaming live from our studios in New York City, and I'd like to welcome you. Today, the latest on health and healing and how we can help our arteries that are frequently clogged and scarred and will cause an early death. We don't want that. We want you to live a long and happy life. So I'm going to show you how to clean up your arteries. Also today, we're going to take a look at an issue that once again, this happens every so often, where people read a headline and then assume that everything that they have heard before that is false. In this one, it's about the probiota, or the good bacteria, really don't do anything. They're worthless. So we took a look at the original claim and found that it's not correct. And I'll explain. So if you're taking probiotics, keep taking them. But I'll also show you the flaw in the study in which they tried to misinterpret this, or it was misinterpreted. Also, today I'm going to give the latest on the oral polio drops that's supposed to have helped eradicate polio in India. Well, it didn't happen. Yes, officially they have no polio in India, but they do have polio in India. In fact, they have hundreds of thousands of cases of polio due to the vaccine. I'll explain based upon scientists from India. This is that sleight of hand that they frequently do. Also today, there's an interesting look at the universe and the how large it is. Well, what if I told you that according to a professor of biology at Indiana University in Bloomington, Jay Lennon, that there are more microbes species on Earth than there are stars in the galaxy. Yeah, and we'll explain that. Also today, a commentary on Gaia theory written by Michael Rose, and who is director of history and philosophy of sciences at Florida State University. I'll be sharing my own understanding of the power of intent and what it can do in keeping us healthy and allowing us to open doors of consciousness that have remained closed, even with all the effort that we go through. Also today, I'll be taking a look at the New York Times. Now, for those of you watching this right now in real time, I'm holding up the entire page of the New York Times, and virtually all this is that I'm going to report on. You have known this long before the New York Times, in some cases, years before the New York Times. And you heard it correctly, accurately, honestly, and objectively. Finally, the New York Times is telling you the same identical thing, except they left something out. What is that? That shows you how complicit they were. I'll get to that when I get to the editorial. So that's what we have to share. And of course, we always begin with something that can help everyone, living a healthier life. This is from a university in Finland, and it talks about low fitness, meaning when you're out of shape, indicates poor arterial health, and that's not good. So this recent Finnish study conducted at the university there showed that adolescents with better aerobic fitness, meaning they exercised, had more compliant arteries than their lower fit peers do. And the study then tells us that a higher aerobic threshold, running, jogging, swimming, biking, is linked to better arterial health. And this was published in the peer-reviewed journal, the European Journal of Applied Physiology. Arterial stiffness, by the way, is one of the first signs of cardiac condition that is bad. And it's when your arteries become stiff, they're at higher risk of cardiovascular events, including, for example, a heart attack and stroke. You remember, I've used this example, an analogy. Think of a brand new water hose. It's pliable, soft. Now let it sit in the sun all summer, and it's stiff and cracked. That's no different than your arteries. Hence, when I'm suggesting start your day with a liquid breakfast and put some coconut oil and flaxseed oil in there and berries, those will help soften the arteries, making them more pliable, heal the tissue, what is called the epithelium, and allow blood to flow through the arteries unimpeded. Now, when you take in any green, whether it's eating a cucumber and lettuce salad, or whether you're having a glass of green juice, or whether you're supplementing with some chlorella or spirulina, you are repairing the damage done inside there and thinning the blood so that your red blood cells are less likely to clump together, aggregate, and cause a stroke, a blockage. Vitamin C does the same thing. So the more often you take vitamin C, even if it's only 1,000 milligrams, five times a day, 3 hours apart, well, for most of the day, and especially before you go to bed at night, you're helping to prevent a heart attack or stroke during the night when a lot of those strokes occur. A new study shows medical cannabis effective in treating a wide range of health conditions. This is from the University of New Mexico. Using a new mobile application technology, researchers at the University of New Mexico found the medical cannabis, the cannabinoids, provide immediate symptom relief across dozens of health symptoms with minimal negative side effects. Two recent studies entitled Patient-Reported Symptom Relief Following Medical Cannabis Consumption and the second article, Effectiveness of Raw Natural Medical Cannabis Flower for Treating Insomnia Under Naturalistic Conditions, published in the journals Frontiers in Pharmacology and Medicines and done at the University of New Mexico by a professor there, show that all kinds of conditions are benefited from the cannabinoids. Now, as we mentioned over a year ago, the Library of Medicine, which is considered the finest repository of quality science published in the United States, and is the largest repository of user-entered information, shows that there are nearly 100,000 recorded user sessions of positive impact, plus over 22,000 studies in peer-reviewed literature on cannabinoids. So it's not, are the cannabinoids capable of helping people with serious conditions? Yes, they are. Even John McCain, who unfortunately was eulogized to death like he was a living god, without looking at the truth of what he did. There was absolutely no one on the left or right politically who were willing to tell the truth about this man. We will. We have. Even today, I'm going to ask Jesse to get up an interview that tells you the truth about him. In any case, I can tell you there was never a war since he's been in power that he didn't support. And the munitions industry, he was their biggest cheerleader. And we put up photographs on my Facebook page showing you being celebrated by terrorists. He's with them. He's in the middle of them. That was also in Iraq as well. And I identified who each of these people were. And the media did not touch it. It's like he was a sacred cow. They couldn't go after that. Because then to go after that, we would have to then say, is the United States directly through the CIA, indirectly through the State Department and Hillary Clinton's State Department, taking Gaddafi's weapons and channeling them through the embassy and the embassy substation in Benghazi to Syria vis-a-vis Turkey and directly to northern Syria? The answer was yes. Well, that's in violation of all treaties. That would have embarrassed the CIA, the State Department, Hillary Clinton, and the Defense Department. So they just all lied about it. And that's why those four Americans were left out there to die when we had planes ready to go and they were all given stand-down orders by the President of the United States. No one has investigated that to told the truth, but that's simply the truth. In any case, what if we had to be honest that we are the world's leading supplier of arms to terrorist organizations, along with Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, Great Britain, and France? It would give a different perspective, right? It would change our perception. So the truth is there. We're just not willing to look at it. Anyhow, I'm going to play in a few minutes a clip that you will not have heard anywhere else that tells you the truth about John McCain. Anyhow, McCain could have used cannabis oil. He could have had alternative therapies. He should speak with the people that I've worked with who had glioblastomas, astrocytomas, gone, live and well today. Same way with end-stage lung cancer. But we don't hear about that. And all we hear is that someone's dying. You know, I remember years ago I got two calls, both from Muhammad Ali and for another well-known, Glenn Campbell. Let's see, who else? There was a French film director whose son came to see me and spent hours. Nice guy. But his stepmother and the French director's wife would not tolerate any alternative mention. She had to go Orthodox. And, of course, he died. And no irony in the fact that you're given a terminal disease sentence, you're going to die. But heaven forbid that you actually try anything else. Well, if you've already been told you're going to die, then ask yourself, what is the problem of trying anything if you're already given a death sentence? So that's what the sum was there to find out. And it just so happens, one of those coincidences in life, when he was there, so were some cancer patients in recovery, improving, who had been given stage 4 terminal conditions, and they were there, and they were now down to stage 2, and one was down to stage 1. So he was very confident. And then he called me about a month later and says, they're not going to do it. Aretha Franklin, someone called me 20 years ago about helping with her health, and I said, she has to want to be healthy. Yeah? I can't work with people who don't want to go into any discomfort. And people's comfort is their number one priority. So there are a lot of people, all the time. Burt Reynolds, same way. He just passed. I happen to have had a friend who used to date Burt Reynolds. She had the highest respect for him as a person, as a human being. Said he was just a terrific human being. This is decades ago. Anyhow, I was asked, would I help him? I said, sure. This goes back 10 years ago. And then again, 5 years ago. But until one of those people pick up the phone and say, hey, I need some help, you can't push a rope up a hill. You can't force, and we don't have any right to proselytize. All we have a right to do is to see how much of a difference we can make in someone's life if they're suffering. Yeah? And if you doubt that, well, there's someone you all know. She's one of the finest broadcasters and social commentary shares in radio, Eutrice Lead. Why don't you ask Eutrice about waking up in the recovery room where they decided not to operate because there was nothing for them to do. She had stage 4B lung cancer, always terminal. That's when I got the call. I'm ready. Until that time, she wasn't ready. And then ask her 6 months later, dropped over 100 pounds, won a race, went from diabetic, non-diabetic, high blood pressure, normal blood pressure, all these arthritis to no arthritis, and long lived past her death date, still alive today. I've been in touch with her in a long time, so I'm hopeful that she's sticking with her protocol, but I don't know. But otherwise, years ago, she had been dead. Why isn't that an important story for anyone? Why isn't someone interviewing her? Why doesn't the Journal of the American Medical Association or the British Medical Journal or the Lancet, New England Journal of Medicine say, hey, tell us your story? And if they say, well, it's only one, we'll give them a lot more. But remember, it requires the person's full commitment. 98% commitment doesn't work. University of Shame, University of California at Santa Barbara, shame on you, well, these three simple words, shame on you, can have devastating effects on an individual's psyche. But why is that? How is the feeling of shame generated, and what is its purpose? Some theorists argue that feeling shame is a pathology, a condition to be cured. Others dismiss it as a useless, ugly emotion. Well, a research team at the University of Montreal and the University of California at Santa Barbara Center for Evolutionary Psychology, however, suggests something altogether different. Shame, they argue, was built into the human nature by evolution because it served an important function for our foraging ancestors. Living in small, highly interdependent bands, the researchers explained, our ancestors faced frequent life-threatening reversals, and they counted on their fellow band members to value them enough during bad times to pull them through. So being devalued by others, deemed unworthy of help, was literally a threat to their survival. Therefore, when considering how to act, it was critical to weigh the direct payoff of a potential action, meaning how much will I benefit by stealing this food, against its social cost, how much will others devalue me if I steal the food, and how likely is it that they will find out? That became critical. Something just to think about. Rhubarb protects against severe damage caused by traumatic brain injury. This is from the South Central University in China. So, when you think of rhubarb, rarely do you eat it, because the herb is a powerful brain food packed with the protective compound rhein, R-H-E-I-N. So a Chinese study reported that eating rhubarb, R-H-U-B-A-R-B, can shield your brain against the side effects of traumatic brain injury that are growing more common these days. Dubbed the silent epidemic, the brain injury is caused by physical impact to the head, like football, soccer, other accidents, and they're followed by secondary brain injuries that trigger serious reactions such as inflammation, oxidative stress. And as you know by listening to this program, oxidative stress is perhaps the biggest instigator of brain malfunctions. When you have a glass of alcohol, you're creating brain inflammation. You smoke cigarettes, you drink alcohol, brain inflammation. You're in a toxic environment, brain inflammation. Now, add your cell phone onto that. Add these G5 towers onto that. Add your flat-screen TVs, all causing brain inflammation. So, rhubarb can help prevent oxidative stress. And in fact, historically, I've always recommended rhubarb because it's helpful in treating chronic liver disease, hepatitis, and sclerosis of the liver. Also, change your diet to save both water and your health. The European Commission Joint Research Center looked at a healthy diet, and it's not only good for us, but it also saves a lot of precious fresh water, according to a new study in the JRC's published Nature Sustainability Journal. So compared to existing common diets, the water required to produce our food could be reduced by 35% if you're eating healthy, and 55% if you go vegan. Well, just imagine saving all that water by going vegan. You're also saving those animals from suffering, and you're saving all that methane from going into the air and increasing the temperature of the planet, which we don't want. So a healthy diet, healthier planet, healthy body. And also, positive psychological well-being can improve your overall heart health. From Northwestern University comes a study that maintaining positive thoughts and feelings can help patients achieve better overall outcomes when it comes to their cardiovascular health. And this was published in the Journal of the American College of Cardiology. So, want to live longer? Be happy. And don't take everything personally. Select your battles. Too many people fight everything, and even though they may be justified at what's wrong, by taking on the whole world and forgetting yourself, you become a casualty of that neglect. Also, finally, a plant used in India in traditional medicine shows great promise for sciatic nerve pain. And this is from the Guru Nanak Dev University in India. And it's known as Saptamai, S-A-P-T-A-P-A-M-I. And it's been used in Ayurvedic medicine as a treatment for various pains and aches for decades. Well, the British Medical Journal, Complementary and Alternative Medicine, recommends it to relieve pain. It's natural, it's non-toxic, and just one more of the things that can make a difference in our lives. That's the latest on health and healing. We're 20 minutes into our program. We're going to take a brief break and come right back. Oh, and by the way, for those of you suffering from COPD, the Sichuan University says milk thistle protects against the disease, especially secondhand smoke, continuing to exacerbate COPD. So that's good. So we're going to take a brief break and come right back. And, oh, before we take that break, let me just mention that I do a lot of filming. In fact, tomorrow we're filming all day. We'll be filming in Poughkeepsie and Kingston and Newburgh and a Native American ceremony over at the Fishkill, and then back in the evening. And we're full, so there's no more room. Some of the people who are coming can help out. There's a photographer for the New York Times, by the way. We have a lot of interesting people are coming who have some skills. And anytime I'm doing local filming, I'll invite different people. So the next time you hear me mention we're running out for a day to film and you want to come, you know, just let us know. But I'm going out sooner than what I expected to do some additional filming. So I'm moving the dance party back till after the retreat so that I don't have to rush back from a trip on the same day, clear out to Seattle. It's just my time wouldn't suggest that. Also, I do a lot of lectures, and I just don't talk about them because they're on my itinerary, and I just run out and do them. But I'm always wearing different outfits, and I even design, like this shirt. I designed my own shirt. I went out to the fabric place in Manhattan in the Garment District. I buy the fabric. I select it. It's not expensive. And then I go to a tailor who's very reasonable. I can get a pair of pants made for about $150, but at least it fits my specific body. And I'm buying something I design, I like, and I like to do that because I first started doing fashion design back when I was in eighth grade. And it didn't come to anything, but it allowed me to, when I look at something, I see an aesthetic that all artists have, and I consider myself artistic. I've done sculpting and all these other things. Anyhow, I'm suggesting that you might want to, before you go to buy your next outfit, think about designing something for yourself. And by going through each stage of it, buying the fabric yourself, you save a lot of money, and there are thousands of different types of fabric you can select. And then having someone do a fitting for you, and then you go back and refit it, and you go back a third time, and it's done. Now you have something that matches your body and whatever occasion you're going to use it for, and it's a lot of savings. Anyhow, that said, I'm going to be giving away a lot of clothes. They're here at our office. They're free. Anybody who would like some clothes, feel free to call and come down and pick something up. I've done this many times in the past. And so just call 646-926-5422. Also, I have two pair of shoes. I've only worn them once, and that's because I was on a shoot for a PBS program, and I realized that the producer came over and said, you got a different black suit, you got brown shoes, I need black shoes. And also, I didn't have any with me, so one of the people went out to a store and bought two, I won't mention the name, but a very high-end, the highest-end quality shoe I think you could buy, brought them back. Trouble is, wrong size. I squeezed into them, and excruciatingly painful, but they're phenomenal shoes, two pair, and they're dress shoes, nice shoes. You can wear them with a suit, men's shoes. I wear a size 14 shoe. And these are size 12. So if your foot is size 12, 11 to 12, they'll fit. It didn't fit for me. That's why I'm giving them away. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. I did a study once, I mentioned it yesterday, where I took a group of individuals who claimed that they had the power of energy exchange, and it was just a concept. There was nothing in the scientific literature. About 2 years after this study, there'd be a small study in McGill University, which is in Canada, did it, but it was mainly on sprouts. So this was different. This was a real challenge. I grew up seeing the power of energy exchange. My mother had the gift. I had the gift. I didn't understand it. I didn't want it. If I explained it, for a young kid, it can scare you. In any case, I saw what she did. And there were a whole group of doctors where I come from. They were called Christian doctors. And they were regular medical doctors in all senses. They practice regular medicine, but the difference was they would sit and hold your hand. They would pray with you. And for a lot of people, they'd think that's stupid, but not to the people where I grew up. They definitely believed in that. And so on the one hand, you'll have your atheists and agnostics say, well, you know, it's wishful thinking. Nothing is happening. For those who have faith deeper than a reductionistic value system, it's very important. And I don't believe that one should be denigrated over the other. We have a right to our views. We have a right to our beliefs. And even when you show examples that the reductionists are limited, in effect they're wrong, it doesn't change anything. They're so certain, they're absolutely certain in their views that uncertainty is never allowed even to posit itself. So I wanted to put it to a pure scientific test. And I had to do it quietly. I got the permission of the director of the institute, and it took several years. But a group of people who claimed they could heal, maybe they could, maybe they couldn't, they came in. But it wasn't with humans they were working. It was with rats. And indeed, a group of these individuals, small group, were able to reverse the conditions, the terminal conditions in these rats, the ascites tumors. And they did it every single time for six times. So it wasn't a fluke. It was an actual phenomena. Now, so we proved the phenomena. We proved that something that had never been tested or proven scientifically before existed, the exchange of an energy. Now, each of these people believed in something different. There was a rabbi, Abraham Wiseman. There was a chiropractor, Dr. Morton Jacobs. There was a physician, Dr. Thomas Kruth. There was a professor, Dolores Krieger at NYU. Each one of the people, and there were several others, had a different rationale for why this occurred. They could have been right or wrong. What we do know absolutely is we proved for the first time scientifically in a very careful study, completely monitored at every level, that there was an exchange of energy. And that started me in my whole work of energy exchange. And I'm still working on that now. In fact, at the new retreat coming up, I'm going to be doing a 10-hour discussion on energy exchange, 2 hours per day. And I'm filming it because I believe this is as important as the life energy work I did 20 years ago. Who are you really? And so that said, today what you have is you have orthodox mainstream science that believes only in linear Newtonian reductionism. Meaning, you can pray, you can sing, you can meditate, you can believe something. It doesn't make it true. In fact, it's not true. And then you have people all over the world who do believe that there is something deeper, something more intrinsic, something more intimately ethereal to our being than just ourselves. Now, this brings me to Gaia, G-I-A-I. And we know of the Gaia principle today mainly because of a scientist, James Lovelock. He created, at that time, a theory of a life in the planet. He was ridiculed. But the question is, was he right? Was he delusional? Now, Michael Ruse, director of history and philosophy of science at Florida State University, believes that you have to look at both sides. And by the way, if you've never read Eon Magazine, I definitely recommend it. They have some of the best literature out there, especially more critical literature on what we become as human beings as we evolve. But Lovelock was an inventor. He was born in England way back, I believe it was around 1919. And what made him famous was during the Second World War, he was armed with a degree in chemistry, and he went to work for the British government on a variety of projects on the borderline between the physical and the biological sciences. And he had this incredible ability to make, well, let's say, gadgets from piles of old junk, often surplus to the military effort. And this continued after the war, and his greatest triumph was to invent the electron capture detector. Now, what is that? Well, the electron capture detector is an instrument so accurate that if one split a solvent on a rag and in Japan, one could detect that in Britain a week later. Now, naturally, a man with such talents attracted attention, and he was freelancing in the early 1960s, and he was often in California aiding with one of his clients, the American Space Agency, NASA, which was just trying to detect if there was life on Mars. Now, here's what gets interesting. Lovelock approached the problem indirectly. Here's what he did. He said there was no need to send robots to the red planet because it wasn't necessary. And why? Now, mind you, this is in the middle of space agencies where you have thousands of contractors dependent upon the need to find out, is there potential for life on this planet? And he's saying, no need to go there. He argued that simply looking at the atmospheric composition of a planet could enable us to know whether that planet was likely to support life, and Mars was the planet. So Lovelock said that it had no life, but Earth obviously was very different. And that is where the entire concept of Gaia originated, that Earth is not just an inert planet. It's teeming with life. The Earth is life. Earth is an organism. Now, he's not alone. Native cultures from time immemorial believe the same thing, but not scientists, and certainly not industrialists, and not those political supporting industrialists who believe in manifest destiny, which, by the way, included almost half of our original founding fathers. That if you have the power to control people, you have the power to take resources you want, then it's yours for the taking. That's very Darwinian, the survival of the strongest, the survival of the fittest, the survival of the smartest. Now, it's not just survival. Pull back for a moment and consider this. Our entire social fabric today is constructed based upon manifest destiny. Now, I bet you haven't heard this in any of your classes, your philosophy class, your social science classes, certainly not your psychology classes. We are led to believe that we are one of two things, either, depending upon the beliefs of the instructor, we either born with an empathetic connection to everyone else, therefore the interest of the group is intrinsically our own interest, so therefore we should be cooperative, we should select to have the community needs met, of which we are one member. Then the dominant philosophy today, and has been for the last 50 years, is that no, you're a unique individual. Therefore, you have to go for everything yourself. Now, you can choose to share some of what you gain in this power struggle as a professional, as a careerist, as an entrepreneur, but that's a choice of free will. It should not be mandated that you must be benevolent, that you must be philanthropic, that no one has a right to come to you and say, you've got all that money, you've got all that power and fame, why don't you give some of it away to those who are needy? They say, if I choose to, A, the rich in America will rarely, if ever, give money directly to anyone because they're only going to give enough that they can deduct it legally. Beyond that amount, their philanthropic needs end. It's a business decision. Rather to get the credit with a publicist publicizing how benevolent you are versus the government just taking his taxes. So, how good are all these foundations that accept money, the American Cancer Society and all these others? In my personal opinion, worthless. I wouldn't give a nickel to any of these foundations. When I help people, and I do, I go out and find the people, people I can talk with, people I can learn their story. Am I going to be able to change their life? No. But at least for a moment in their life and my life, I will have honored them as being a human being, irrespective of the conditions they're in, the circumstances they have met. Now that is not reductionistic. That is not a part of the manifest destiny, and certainly not in alignment with anything representing the Darwinian philosophy of life. And all of our professional class today are Darwinian. They want to survive by going into careers, and the career then is competitive with other careers in the same competition to get the outcome, who's going to get the Nobel Prize, who's going to get the Pulitzer Prize, who's going to get the next patent, who's going to get preferential treatment, who's going to become elected, and how can they exceed over other people. It's as if there's a classic iconic photograph from the late 1800s of over a million skulls of bison. Now, they weren't killed for their meat. They were killed to deprive Indians from them and for their fur. What you have today on almost every career is you have people competing against each other, and if you lose, you become one of the skulls. And we pride ourselves on the one who is in this moment, the top rapper. It doesn't matter if they're a good person, if they made their money by mocking, demeaning, defaming women and the female, the misogynist. Doesn't matter. There won't be any responsive issue of should we support someone who is inhumane, who's racist, who is bigoted, who's misogynist. We don't care. Almost everyone in power is defective, at just degree. In music, we allow you to be not just defective, we allow you to be hedonically depraved. And so we actually are disappointed when someone is actually nice or decent. It kind of shocks us. We're used to seeing the lowest level of depravity. But we also see it in politics. We see it in the Catholic Church. We see it in so many places. We see it in the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. We see it in Syria. We see it in Lebanon. Everywhere you look, you're going to see this depravity. How could that be possibly existing unless you have manifest destiny where people believe that their rights, their power in that moment supersede everyone else's rights and power? And when they win or they're in power, they're not judged for it, rarely. And those who do judge them are almost always attacked. So it's a winner take all. That is purely Darwinian. It has nothing to do with Gaia. Because if we live by Gaia principles, we'd be looking at what is essential and what is eternal in every energy exchange, the human spirit. Well, there is no spirit in politics. None. Zero. Not a single politician. Show me one. Call right now and show me one person who's a spiritualist who's in power. Gandhi wasn't allowed to share that. Martin Luther King wasn't. The people who could have done that were always the ones excluded and frequently killed. So it shows you what we're now hardwired by epigenetic conditioning, where that becomes our belief system. It's mine. I earned it. I get it. I deserve it. I don't care about you. You're poor. I'll walk by you. Your home's a ghetto. Too bad for you. That's what's happening. That's what allows us to desensitize ourselves to the suffering of others in our society. Isn't that foolish? I just visited my hometown over the weekend. It took four planes to get there and back, but it was worth it. I was early to the dinner, and I took 5 hours to walk the streets of my neighborhood. I think all of us want to go back and not be limited by Thomas Wolfe's "You Can't Go Home Again," but rather, what can I learn from going home again? Well, when I saw the streets that were growing up, it was just a middle class, normal neighborhood, no big homes, but nice. Everything was nice, manicured, no doors closed, no robberies, no muggings, no murders. Now it's a complete ghetto. My entire town is a ghetto. I went by and remembered the house, looked at the house I was born in, and one block over the house I lived in till I was out of high school. Looked at the college I first went to there, Mountain State College, and I walked every single area, not just a block, dozens of blocks, all the same. And when I would stop to speak with people who would be sitting on a porch, they would tell me that it's just all drug addiction. It's all heroin and methamphetamine. It's everywhere. Guy said, "See that house across the street, that big white house? That's where all the drug addicts go at night." He said, "It's empty now, but wait till 1 o'clock in the morning. This whole area is just going to be alive with people, all drugs, drive-by shootings common." And he said that I'd actually gone up a place called Quince Hill because one of my buddies, a big guy, like 6'8", 285, we used to work out together, a bunch of us in a garage. We didn't have a Y. And he lived there. And I said, "Does Big Jim?" "Oh, no, he didn't live here. He sold his house. But he came by last year. He just wanted to look to see." He said he lived here and was born here and wanted to see what it was like. It was all ghettoized. And I asked these people, "Any work?" He said, "No, all the factories closed down. You can get work, but, you know, if it's $6, $7, $8 an hour, you can't get enough to live on. And so the people are living around here are all poor." Excuse me, that's the disintegration of a social fabric where there is no Gaia. And I walked and walked. In fact, I was able to walk from Blennerhassett Hotel, which is the bottom of my town, up Market Street, totally gone. And I walked for over a mile and a half before I saw one human being. It's like a ghost town. Like something out of a sci-fi movie. It was just weird because this was the epicenter of where we grew up, and there was vitality, and there was life, and there was joy and happiness, and there was the ability to believe we could do and be anything because we live with very positive reinforcement and discipline and manners and respect for each other. So that night, when I finished my walk, I went to where the reunion was, and boy, you talk about depressing. Whoa. I walked in, and I'm standing there, and I'm thinking I'm in the wrong room. So I walked back out again. And then I saw the other room beside it was empty. So I walked back. And I walk over to this table. I said, "Is this the Parkersburg High School reunion?" They said, "Yeah." "Who are you?" I said, "I'm Gary Knoll's son." I thought I'd freak him out. And they said, "Oh, okay." And then, did we look different? Whoa. And then one of my best buddies growing up came over to me. I didn't recognize him. They give you that little picture and, you know, from high school with their name on it. Had I not seen that, I wouldn't know who he was. I didn't know a single person in there from how they look today. Old, overweight. And as I spoke to probably 50 or 60 of them, out of about, I'm guessing, around 150 that are there, they had all lived good lives, school teachers, engineers. They were all retired. And when I ask them, "What do you do all day?" they didn't do anything. And when I say, "No, you got to do something. You got 24 hours to fill." "Nah, you know, watch television." "Well, what about society? The whole place is just, yeah, we know. It's all around us. What are you doing about it?" "Well, there's nothing to do." Just absolute apathy. In fact, one of my buddies, his son, he told me, is head of detectives. And he said the drugs have literally taken over the entire town. But not just here, Huntington, Charleston, Wheeling. So I looked at the information, and sure enough, the town had shrunk in size substantially, as had Wheeling, Charleston. And then they just indicted the entire Supreme Court of West Virginia. And we all know that the east side of West Virginia, very tiny state, you can drive through the state in 2.5 hours, but the entire area where the real Appalachia begins, that is depressed in oxytocin. It's number one user of these opiates in America of any state per population. Now it's the west side of West Virginia, from all the way down the state, Wheeling, Moundsville, Parkersburg, Beckley, Huntington, Charleston, Bluefield. It's all the same. Industries have gone. Poverty has moved in. Drug addiction has moved in. And everything has gone into this deep apathy. Now, that's happening everywhere in America. I can go to any state and find communities just like this. But until you're there, until you see this, until you see that the people are all unhealthy, and when I ask, would you like a protocol? Nope. Okay. So you're not only got heart disease and diabetes and cancers and dementia, you don't want to change. So this is one of the realities we're not willing to look at in America. How much of our sickness is due to seeing the support system that we once thought was wonderful no longer supporting us? So we withdraw into the microcosm of our existence. Go to school, come home, go to some events occasionally, and just wait to die. It's a sober reminder. Anyhow, in the mid-1960s, Lovelock returned to the somewhat isolated village in the south of England where he lived. And there he was with his family, and he talked with a friend of his. Now, I'm sure you've heard of the novelist William Golding, a man who likewise sought solitude, and especially since the success of his first novel, The Lord of the Flies, back in, I believe it was 1954. And it was Golding who gave a name to Lovelock's insight, suggesting that it be called Gaia, after the ancient Greek goddess of Earth. But Golding did more than just give the idea a name. For the next few years, as Lovelock extended his thinking on the subject, Golding encouraged and helped the scientists to explore his hypothesis. Remember, it wasn't a certainty, it was just an idea, a hypothesis. And this came naturally since his youth, Golding had been an enthusiast of the thinking of the polymath and mystic Rudolf Steiner. I've mentioned Rudolf Steiner. They have great schools like the Waldorf School or the Steiner School in the system, the organic growing, biodynamic growing. That's all Rudolf Steiner. The theosophist and the theophysist are a very big believer in heavenly spirits. They believe in reincarnation, whether you do or don't. And that was all bound up with an idealistic philosophy that sees life, listen carefully, life throbbing everywhere. Hence, absolutely central to Steiner's thought was the view that the earth is living. It's an organism. But he wasn't the first. Native Americans have been believing the earth was alive forever. So Lovelock did send one of his sons to a Steiner school, and he enjoyed it without the metaphysics. Nonetheless, in Golding, he found a sympathetic listener who was, in any case, prime for his longstanding interest in Steiner's philosophy to hear that Earth was a living thing. And Lovelock went public with the guy in the early 1970s. By then, he had found the right collaborator from within mainstream science. And as it happens, the American microbiologist Lynn Margulis never much cared for the guy ideas much, but from her undergraduate years onward, by the way, she graduated at 14. She was a fervent believer in symbiosis. If you don't know what symbiosis, symbiosis, it's the idea of organisms coming together for mutual benefit. In fact, she had in a major work published in the mid-1960s, something that was eventually to give her respect and fame in the scientific community. Margulis argued that complex cells were formed by more primitive cells, swallowed up by other simple cells. Now, these simple cells, she argued, became functional parts, the organelles, of their now more complex host. Among the parts that had this origin were the mitochondria and the power plants of our cells, and the chloroplasts, the parts of the plant cell that perform photosynthesis. And for some thinking this way, the idea of Earth as an integrated functioning entity was vitally and virtually a premise, not a deduction. And so Margulis was collaborating with Lovelock on a series of papers arguing for Gaia. And so they went on to this theory, and they argued substantially for it, but it was rejected. They were rejected, substantially rejected. She went off on other directions. But from that, a lot of people were motivated. And that's where the New Age movement really began to evolve, where many of the people in that original first stage New Age movement began to consider that we were more than just inhabitants on a planet. We were all connected. And there was not much reaction to these papers. And by the mid-1970s, everything was starting to change. People might have been somewhat sympathetic to Gaia, that the spirit is a part of life, and therefore you're nurturing your spirit by good thoughts and good behavior and helping others, and you're doing what is good for the common, for the whole. And all that was fought by the reductionist. My turn, get out of the way. Me too, I'm bigger, I'm smarter, I'm stronger. I'm going to lead the way. You're all peasants, you follow. That's what we had. That's the Bill Gates. That's the hedge fund managers. That's the equity partners, the economic parasites of society. That's Wall Street. That's the whole Bill Clinton and all the other young new Democrats who were really just entrepreneurial and following this reductionistic consequence. So Lovelock persisted and increasingly took his case to the public arena. And this climaxed in 1979 with the publication of his book, Gaia, A New Look at Life on Earth. And if you haven't read it, I definitely recommend you do. And after that, he did an autobiographical book. And from that day till this, Lovelock has never left the public eye. And so that's where we get Gaia. So on the strength of all that has happened, he was elected to the Royal Society in London. He also became, in the mid-1980s, a member of the National Academy of Sciences. And also we have what is called the Matthew effect. Maybe you've never heard of Matthew, M-A-T-T-H-E-W. And that's what sociologists of science riffing on the Bible passage about the rich get richer, the poor get poorer, call it when eminent scientists are given far more recognition for the same work that their less well-known colleagues have. But that's Lovelock and Margulis were mocked and scorned by the profession. And Richard Dawkins, I'm not a fan of Richard Dawkins. I think he's highly literate and extremely ignorant on life. For those of us who actually seen the power of belief, then the rampant raging, narcissist of that group of Dawkins wannabes. He wrote The Selfish Gene back in 1976, and he led the baying pack, and he objected to Gaia, and because what? He is a evolutionary proponent, an ardent opponent of group selection. He could not accept that things could happen for the good of the group simply because they were for the good of the group. Plants don't produce carbon dioxide, he said, for the sake of the earth. Either it was a byproduct of their function, or it must be an immediate benefit for the plants themselves. any other interpretation was contrary to Darwinian view of life, and they won't budge. They won't go outside. They won't touch anything that resembles faith, belief, or even good science. And a few years later, John Postgate, a microbiologist and fellow at the Royal Society, was withering in his critique. He said the guy was the biggest pile of nonsense he'd ever come to. Well, today what we have is we have the New York Times. And here on the top left page, it says, cancer doctor didn't disclose corporate ties, paid millions by firms linked to research. This is by Charles Hornstein and Katie Thomas. Quote, one of the world's top breast cancer doctors failed to disclose millions of dollars in payments from drug and health care companies in recent years, omitting his financial ties from dozens of the research articles in prestigious journals like the New England Journal of Journal. And it goes on to talk about how he was connected with drugs he was promoting that were not beneficial. All right. Then you have here. Do you remember we told you about 3 months ago that China was putting lots of Islamic people into detention camps? People said, no, that's all nonsense, quackery. Front page, full page, right here, the New York Times. Anti-Islam and detention center camps in China. Minorities swept up in the biggest internment program since Mao's era. Goes on to talk about the millions of people they've affected. We were right before them. Over here, quote, U.S. met rebels from Venezuela about coup plot risked by Trump officials. This talks about how the Trump organization and its national security people were meeting with dissidents in Venezuela to destroy the democratically elected government down there and to topple them, Maduro's government. And that meant sanctions that caused starvation. Again, we told you about this, but why is it nowhere in here when they're mentioning the United States intervention in Nicaragua and other countries? Why didn't they mention Honduras? Why didn't they mention something that's recent that we have absolutely irrefutable proof through WikiLeaks that Hillary Clinton was the apostle heading this whole new type of inquisition? If you're not with us, we're against you. We need your resources. Don't get in our way. She did it in Syria. She did it in Libya. She did it in Ukraine. And she did it in Honduras. Not a mention of that. So this is just to show you these all have something in common. A, none of this would have happened if these people had practiced anything representing spiritual connection or the Gaia. They all happened from this rich doctor over here at Sloan Kettering, the top doctor, Sloan Kettering, because of unmitigated greed, selfishness, and the absolutism of, if I can get it, it's mine. I don't have to share it with you, mindset. The selfish elite. And the elite, there are probably 130 million elite in this society, not 1%. Boy, did you get it wrong there. And that kind of manifest destiny, a kind of Darwinian philosophy, survival of the fittest. That's what you see everywhere today in the media. We're out of time. I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Gary Nall. Have a nice day. Oh, my love, my darling.